Hello, everybody. My name is Eric Forsberg, and I'm a grateful Al-Anon. This has been just an outstanding weekend for me. This conference has been absolutely stunning. I am really taken back by just how authentic, how powerful, how hungry the recovery is in this area. It's very inspiring to me. And yeah, you guys are magnificent people. Absolutely magnificent. And you know, there's let me quickly get a few things that I wanted to say out of the way first. Thank you, Emmett, for calling me and asking me to participate in my own recovery. I appreciate that. And the trust that you guys put in me. I called my sponsor, Jack, about an hour ago. And I think he knows about a third of the room at least. I'm always impressed with how many people that man has met and knows. And when I arrived here Friday, and everything started to kick off, I began to hear people sharing their recovery, and I could hear in what you guys are sharing some of the recovery that obviously comes from that sponsorship circle that we're hearing, and that helped me feel like I was already home, and that was pretty magnificent. That's a pretty wonderful way for God to show off. And today, you know, I have a higher power, and my higher power has my picture on in the fridge, and he's just crazy about me. And I didn't know that I had that kind of a higher power until I came to know people like you. And I'll get into that a little bit later when I talk about the steps. I want to also thank the, council or panel or whatever you call it, all the various folks that have like stepped up to be of service throughout this weekend. I know my home group is the La Cañada Men's Stag meeting on Thursday nights at 7 p.m. There's about somewhere between 70 and 100 men that meet every week, about this size. And it's an incredible privilege to be in and among men in recovery. And in those meetings, you'll hear men sob like babies and not be ashamed of it. Because the other guys will, like, give them a hard time if they don't cry. Think about that, eh? Peer pressure working backwards, like, and undoing all those old, like, you know, old ideas and old ways of living. I don't normally say this when I share, but I will tonight. I feel impressed to say it. I've been in Al-Anon about 12 years, and I wasted most of that time when I was in program. And I had a whole lot of ideas in my mind about what recovery was, and I didn't want Al-Anon's recovery path to get in the way of my getting better. Problem was, I didn't really know what Al-Anon was about. I just thought I had my own preconceived notions of what recovery should be. And it was largely, it had a lot to do with things like the fact that I had studied psychology in university. I went to U of T. I grew up in Ottawa, so you'll hear this really weird accent coming out of this boy here. You're going to hear a little bit of the Midwest, and you're going to hear some Canadian Fargo-esque mixture. And it's because my parents are both Americans. They lived in the Midwest. A year or two before I was born, they were living it up, living la vida loca, in Monterey, California, during the mid '60s, when that whole scene was exploding with the Who and all kinds of, like, Jimi Hendrix. I remember. What is it? My oldest brother, who's a massive jazz trumpet player. There's lots of musicians in my family. And He was like sleeping in the backyard because he didn't want to be in the house. You can hear an Al-Anon story coming on in here, don't you? And it's like he's sleeping in the back, and I said to him, when you were out in the back, you know, sleeping in that tree fort or whatever under the stars, you must have heard Jimi Hendrix playing Down in the Harbor when he crashed the U.S. scene. Do you remember that? And he goes, no. I was like, good. You should have left friggin' like that place, you know. You don't appreciate it, you know. But my parents are from there, and I grew up in, my dad went to Ottawa to take a job there to help basically get a California, or he was working for California Parks. He was hired to come into the federal government and help them build a national park system. And I always thought my dad was a geek and a loser, but it turns out in recovery, he's actually rad. maybe changed attitudes does aid recovery, you know, like when they say, yeah, more will be revealed. They're not kidding. But it was like growing up for me, you know, I was the first kid born in a family of that would end up being 14 kids. And I was number 8. It's my favorite number to this day. I didn't make that connection until my 4th step. And I felt like the only child in a family of 14. Alcoholism it doesn't seem to just sort of, you know, jump through our family. It just galloped. I mean, it just went right through it. And my father, you know, his dad ended up dying an alcoholic death. He was a man who ended up drinking himself into what they call like a wet brain condition. I don't know if you know what that is. It just means you drink until you stop eating. And then the lack of nutrition causes your brain to basically turn to mush, and you become about 4 years old. And when my dad, you know, only ever really talked about his dad around me maybe 2-3 times. One time he mentioned the alcoholic wet brain thingy, and I kind of like stowed that away as like, that's interesting. I don't know what that means, but I guess maybe I'll come back to that. And then other times he'd talk about like the last time that he saw him. And none of these were good stories. Like my dad said that the last time he saw his father, he walked in to the home where they were taking care of him in that wet brain condition. And he walked in the room where his father was situated. And he said, hey, Revere, it's your son. It's Clyde. And his father turned around, looked at him like he was a nurse, and began to pull his pants down like it was time to go to the bathroom, because he had no sense of who it was that had just walked in the room. It was a shell of a man. And my dad talked about that with this sense of shock and terror that drink could do that to somebody. And so I think it was his desire to protect me and the rest of my family by separating us from my grandfather. And, you know, I'm an adult grandchild of an alcoholic. And so he figured, you know, maybe the solution to alcoholism is a great big lot of distance. And so moving from California all the way over to Ontario, Canada. And by the way, there's an Ontario in Los Angeles. Did you know that? Yep. So when I moved there with my Ontario plates, they just let me keep them. They thought, ooh, that's cool. I didn't know they made Ontario plates here for California. I laughed at that. I thought that was great. Criminal enterprises of Canadians, moving into the U.S. But anyway, I'm convinced today that he did everything that he could to protect and separate us and from what he thought was just a terrible influence, something that should be forgotten, and put away and never looked at again and ignored. And let's just hope none of that moves down the line or down the hill. And so as we were growing up, you know, stuff started happening. Let me tell you my first memory as a child. I love this because it's totally an Al-Anonic one. I just remember being about three-ish, maybe three and a half, and I was built like a little tank, even though I was scrawny, like a mouse. And in our home, with all the family members around, naturally, you know, I think our house only had about two or three rooms. Do the math. You don't have bunk beds, right? You have triple bunk beds. You have like all kinds of really cool contraptions that we built. And I remember thinking, I remember going over to one of the beds at the age of three and a half and grabbing like the wood and just using all the strength in my legs and lifting it. And I could get it off the ground at three and a half. And then I had to go tell everybody I could do it and show them. Oh, yeah, I was an attention grabber right from day one. So, like, yeah, first memories. I love sitting down sometimes after meetings with people and asking them, what was the very first memory that you ever had? And I haven't met somebody yet who hasn't told me an Al-Anonic story. Because it's the thing that really impresses you the most, you know? At least it has been for me. And so I played with a lot of toys. There wasn't really a lot going on because the older siblings would just sort of beat on us little kids. And so, you know, two parents against an army of, you know, 1,000 or whatever of Indians. And we were just like, you just get pummeled. And so I remember like collecting some of these like trinkets that we had around the house. My mother had collected a couple of old wickered wine bottles, the Italian style, you know, ones. And she kept those to put candles in. And she had some of those great big bristlecone pine things that you can get, you know, where the large growth happened here on the coast. They're huge. They're like about this big. And I remember like playing with those like they were toys. And I remember walking around with these two like wine juggy things. And of course, couldn't walk too well. And so as I was walking down, like looking like this, you know, scattered brain, I don't know what, my sister Angie looks at me and she goes, oh, look, it's a drunk, it's a boozer. And the nickname stuck. My family called me to this day Booze. And the irony's not lost on me. I don't have the allergy, but the, you know, this is what happens in alcoholic families. Your nickname is even alcoholic. And, you know, I just remember, like, sort of growing up, and things were pretty good. Like, I was pretty happy. I know my parents were thrilled to kind of have a refresh, a restart with their lives. And when I was born, they were very happy to have me. And it was very much a celebration of, like, okay, we're going to start again here. Things in California had gotten really hairy. I didn't know that. And so a refresh sounded pretty good. But as I got older, you know, I noticed that the way that my mom and my dad related to each other, it was like they just became completely obsessed with each other. And if you don't know what the word obsession means, I'll just give you a real simple definition of what it means to obsess. Just means you think a lot about something. And they just, that's like, as soon as my dad was home from work, they were together. You know, if it was on the weekend, they were together. They were doing stuff. And it was like they had no time for anybody else but themselves. And so I ended up just sort of growing up, even when things were good, feeling like I better just kind of take care of me because I got to fend off the older brothers and sisters that were going to come after me. To either make me their slave or to, you know, somehow like, you know, go crazy on me or whatever. And so there wasn't much protection going on. And I felt, well, to use a word that we've already studied this weekend, you know, I felt very nervous all the time. And I I figured, okay, well, whatever. It wasn't too bad. It was, I started to develop essentially, you know, at the age of four, I think, this tolerance of really, really nasty stuff. It's just normal. This is just the way things are. Just get used to it. It's not going to change. And so when kindergarten came around, I remember like my parents said, okay, great, great. Dad's off to work. Mom's just burnt out already just from waking up and like helping us, you know, make breakfast. And so, Eric, you just go out and sit out on the front lawn and wait for the bus to come pick you up. Now, it's my first day of school. And I don't know that parents are supposed to take you to your first day of school because, for heaven's sakes, you're a five-year-old, right? Only I don't think of myself as a five-year-old at five. I think of myself as much older. And so I go out there and I sit and I wait. And I just remember, like, I started to get terrified, but I didn't tell anybody. And I started to feel really sad and alone. And I just remember the bus came, and it was a retard bus, like the short ones. And I felt like a retard getting on the bus, because I was like, where am I going? They're just taking me away, aren't they, to the funny farm. And I go off to, like, French immersion school, which to my dad, my parents are Americans, and so it's like, all right, buddy, you know, like, you're going to be the first, like, French-Canadian kid of our American family, you know. When I come home from school, they wouldn't teach me how to speak in French because they didn't know any. And so I remember coming back from kindergarten at the end and telling my parents, what am I supposed to do now? I failed kindergarten. I don't know any, I have only ever met, like, I think two other people on the universe that failed kindergarten. What'd you do, Eric? Like, did you not play with the toys right? You know what I'm saying? But it turns out, like, in French immersion, you actually have to learn how to speak some French before you can take classes in it. And I didn't know anything. And so they just threw me into grade one and a regular English class. And I was grateful for that. But it stunted, it shaped and shifted me, like, for probably 20 years after that, I would think I was a terrible, terrible person when it came to, like, any kind of the language skills. Turns out today that's what I do for a living. And so I did all that and worked my way through that. And our family would have these, like, gatherings. They were called family council meetings, but secretly we called them bitch sessions because that's all they were, just complaining. But it was kind of like our group consciences that we have in Al-Anon, where everybody gets in and you just trying to control it is like herding cats, you know what I'm saying? And I, up to this point, still believe that if I let my parents know how I was really feeling about some of the chores I was doing, that would make a difference, that mattered. So when it became my turn to ask, you know, how's things going, Eric? What's wrong? What's going on? I remember, like, just bursting out in tears and saying, why do I always have to wash the dishes on Sunday? You know, and my mother, bless her heart, just looked at me and said, next. And something happened inside of me. It completely changed me in an instant, like that. Is that hurt worse than anything that had ever happened to me in my life? Like, and I'm only five, so I don't have an emotional arsenal. I don't have tools for living. I adopted a couple of ideas that would stay with me for years after that and shape all my relationships, in fact. And it was just the idea that no one really cares about how I feel or what I need. So I guess it's all up to me. And I just remember, like, that hit so home for me at that age that I was like, wow, that became the gospel of Eric. And in all my relationships, I would act like that was absolutely true. And, you know, so It was awkward growing up around in our home. There was a lot of crazy stuff going on. I never felt like okay or settled. I didn't understand what was wrong in our family. There was this feeling of desperation, like to look really good on the outside. But when we would go home, please, let's never talk about what happens there. You know, the amount of like physical abuse that I ended up enduring was the kind usually they take kids out of homes for. And in our home, that was just normal. That was just a regular day. That was just Thursday. And, you know, I figured, you know, well, at least we can look good on the outside and pretend from time to time. And I got a lot of relief from that. And so I would go to school and I try to look like a regular kid and I try to act like a normal and usual person, you know, that had a mom and dad and everybody was nice, you know, at least on the outside. And I do that at the church that they raised us in. And as long as I could pretend for a while, that actually worked for quite a bit. Until my mother decided that she was done with my father, and she just up and left one night. I think it was on the night that my sister Angie decided to get married. And so my sister Angie had to put her marriage like plans on hold, literally, because that had happened. And all of a sudden, I was from a broken family, and I couldn't hide behind the facade our family had presented itself. And I just remember feeling like everyone can see what kind of a loser I am. I can't hide it anymore. And I remember going through some years, like 3-4 years, where, you know, and it's funny how it all happened right when I was like sort of entering puberty. So it was like the level of confusion that I was going through was like off the charts. And I remember during that period doing things, acting out in ways that were like, they're very uncharacteristic of the man that I am. Broke into people's homes and stole money. I pulled food out of their fridge. I vandalized people's properties. I broke into stores. I would go to the school and jump up on top of it and look for toys to play with during the summers. I just was willing to do anything to get outside of what the hell that was going on inside of me. Because the pain of having lost my mother, who I loved with all my heart. And to be left with a father who had lost his wonder wall, his meaning of life. His rage would reach levels that usually are just beyond what most people can even fathom. And I'm going through all of this and I'm thinking, you know, it must be my fault that she left because I didn't do good enough chores. I just would take on the responsibility of a failed marriage at that age. And I did a lot of different things like that. Like, so if you're an Al-Anon and somebody else does something embarrassing and you get embarrassed, I want to welcome you to Al-Anon. When somebody else doesn't pay their debt and you go, I'll pay that, I want to welcome you to Al-Anon. You know, because as Al-Anons, that's kind of what we do. I mean, we take on the hurt. We take on the fear. We take on the guilt of other people, like it's ours. And like the blood pain, you know, we just take on that past and carry it. We think we're doing a great legacy for our families when we do that. At least I did. And so, you know, things progressed. It didn't get any better or easier when I got into my teen years, you see, because as a teenager now, I should have some control over my life. I'm no longer a child. I can't blame all the crap that's happened on my parents. And so when I get into the dating world and I start doing that, I discover that, like, oh, wow, I don't have any relationship skills at all. And I ended up, like, going on several different dates. And for me, a record was 2 weeks. And if they, and if I dumped them, that was a miracle. That was a modern miracle for me. And it was usually because I had somebody waiting in the wings. So, like, and that was a miracle too. So, but I have this sense, like, well, I should just know how to date. Well, I should just know how to do that without, you know, any help or any need for help or asking anybody. And I was just deathly afraid of being rejected, largely because, you know, when the ultimate woman in your life leaves your life, the woman that you are, that half of you is, that shakes you to the core. I mean, it did for me. And so I just couldn't imagine, you know, anything that resembled rejection was just scary as all get out. And So when it came to dating, I only had like two skills or two criteria really for dating. Who would I date? Well, okay. She just had to know two things. She had to be cute, number one. And two, she had to know my name. That was it. And so, you know, I can't tell you how many awesome relationships I had started like that and ended terribly. So. But I remember graduating from high school, and I was, the outlook for my life was so bleak. I remember just thinking in my deep way, you know, my artistically deep. I'm like, well, you know, maybe I won't see past 21, so who cares about a future? I just couldn't imagine my life past 21. And so, you know, I go out and I work for a little while, and it takes me away from Ottawa a little bit, and I come back, and then I meet her. If you're a guy in Al-Anon, crazed for love, and desperately in need of some major recovery, you know what I mean by her. The one, you know? Check it out. She's beautiful, and she knows my name. It's on. So we start seeing each other, and within the first 2 weeks, she asked me to marry her. I didn't see that as a red flag. I was just like, I'm so glad to hear that. I don't want to do this dating thing anyway, you know? And I just remember feeling really wanted and loved. And but later, you know, I just, I would settle for feeling needed. And so I moved to Toronto, and about 5 minutes later, I ended up getting married. And I don't know why you think that's funny. We love fast, and we marry fast in my family. And so I went to night classes, you know, to prep for university, and I ended up going on welfare there for about the first year just to kind of make that work. And that was a real low for me. Because the family I grew up, and you work, you pay your way for everything. But for me, it just seemed like a small price to pay in order to be with somebody that I thought I wasn't worthy of. And so my wife went to theater college in the days and nights, and we did that for about 2 years. Notice I said we did that. You know, she cried a lot. I thought that was so endearing. That wasn't a red flag either. And I, when she would cry, I would just sort of sit back and hurt. Because somehow I felt like it was my fault. And so if she hurt, well, so did I. If she had troubles, well, I'd just drop everything and attend to those. And if she needed anything, I'd pretty much go without if I had to. to give her what she wanted. I just figured that's what love was. And I found myself, you know, swearing to my friends and those who knew me that I was never going to be like my father or mother. And here I was recreating exactly that kind of relationship where all we did was obsess over each other. And so I get into the university I desire to go to, which at the time was University of Toronto. And, you know, I ended up doing very well there. It took me actually one of the summers I came and worked here in Vanscoy. And so when I was asked to come to this location to give a pitch like this, I remember telling Emmett here that, oh, yeah, I've been over at Vanscoy. And he says, I'm so sorry. And I was like, well, it was 98. It was a long time ago. So, and I just remember that helped me to feel like I was doing something in my life. And I'd later think that, you know, the acquisition of knowledge might be powerful enough to solve this disease later to find out that we don't suffer from a lack of knowledge. We suffer from a lack of power. It's a spiritual illness. And as if that wasn't interesting enough, I end up joining a band. I couldn't play guitar. It didn't seem to matter at the time. And I figured I'd just learn as I go. And I did. And it turned out this is something me and my wife loved to do. She was very encouraging, which meant the world to me. I'd later learn to discover that as an Al-Anon, one of my greatest relationship needs is encouragement, 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 because of all the fear that is just a constant in my life. And she provided that. She was really wonderful that way. And we ended up to go on and have some success for a time. I ended up being on Much Music a little bit and got to play in some music festivals. And then I had the opportunity to, through a friend, go and score some music for a really bad film in California. And while all of this is going on, it's no big deal that me and my wife have separated twice. That's just how love goes when you care. You know, you kick each other out a little bit and then get back together and it's better. And I come to learn later that the success rate in people who physically separate is like 85%, it's like 15% each time. And so by the time I was moving to California to pursue, you know, this opportunity that I was just mentioning, you know, we'd already made it through two separations. And I don't chalk that up to us being awesome people. I think the obsession is what held us together. And I just remember, like, you know, we did music for about five more years. And, you know, the whole time, like, things are going really, really well. And, you know, I take a job during the daytime to kind of keep my evenings and weekends open. And the more and more I'm in this relationship and trying to also do this career together, the more and more friends drop by the side, and there's really no connections. There's just, we became very much more and more and more isolated with one another. And so we're seeing therapists, and remember my wife says to me, she goes, you know what, Eric, there's two things you got to do, because I'm tired of being in this sinking ship. That's what she called our marriage. And she goes, one, you got to go get this sleep thing, the sleep problem you have, the sleep apnea thing. You have to go get that taken care of, because I'm tired of watching you almost die every night. That's driving me crazy. And the other thing is you got to go out and get some sort of help, you know, family help and that sort of thing. Some kind of a self-help program, because I'm tired of carrying your weight. And I remember thinking, like, she doesn't love me enough, man. Like, look at all I've done for her. I got her into the U.S., blah, blah, blah. And so I remember going to the therapist and asking them, like, okay, so what should I do? Where should I go? And the therapist had said to me, well, why don't you consider going to Al-Anon? And I was like, Al-Anon? What's Al-Anon? I'd never even heard the phrase before. And she goes, well, you've heard of AA? And I went, yeah. Well, Al-Anon's for the friends and families of alcoholics, that's where they go to get better. You know, they're dealing with the effects of somebody else's drinking. And I was like, well, I haven't been bothered by anybody's drinking. That's never bothered me. I think alcoholics are a lot of fun, actually. I've been in a lot of bars playing a lot of different bands, you know, like they're the party, they're the crowd to be with. And she says, well, okay, Eric, let me put it to you another way. She grabbed me by the short and curlies, and she said, you might learn a thing or two about healthy relationships. And I went, oh, okay, you got me there. You know, because I came into Al-Anon as just like a social pygmy, just super ignorant of how to relate. And so I began the process of going through the steps. I didn't take long. I grabbed a sponsor fast. And I didn't do that, by the way, to recover. I did that because I wanted my wife to look at me and say, good job. And that's why I don't remember the month I came into Al-Anon, because I really was coming in to leave. You know, I figured 3-4 months, that'd be enough. And I'm glad I was wrong about that. And so I came in, and I started to get better, and our marriage just started to tank fast. And I realized that my wife, being really smart and much more healthier than I was at the time, she was just sending me somewhere so she wouldn't feel so bad when she, you know, cut the bait and left, and I'd be in good hands. And she did the right thing. And so she went her own way, and I just remember like feeling just like my dad must have felt when my mother left him. Like the whole reason for existing is now gone. What do you do now? My whole identity was wrapped up in being a husband, being a bandmate. Like all these things had been, they had disappeared overnight. And all the stuff that had happened to me when I was younger that I had stuffed for years and years, all of a sudden started to flood back up all at once, all together. And I came in, and my knees buckled. And it was you people that actually brought me in. And you did strange things like hug me, give me 3 minutes every meeting of uninterrupted talking. That wasn't happening at home. And you told me that you loved me, and you told me you wanted me to come back. And those simple things are life-giving things. I thank you for that. And I, you know, went through like a program, like I said, you know, just because I had studied psychology, I figured, oh, maybe I can understand this whole recovery process without actually doing it. And so I bought all your literature, and I went home and I read most of it, and I thought, oh, none of this stuff makes any sense to me. It's all backwards. And sounds really good. So, you know, I started to do the steps, and I started to get a little bit better. But, I mean, I came in crushed, absolutely devastated. And I almost had no will to live. It was that bad. And I found myself like going through steps 1 and 2 and 3 out of the past recovery book. And then when I would get to step 4, this nagging idea would happen in my head about how much of a jerk my sponsor is. I can't read my 4-step to this guy, so I'd go and pick a different sponsor. And that sponsor would say something like, oh, well, what step are you on? Oh, you're just starting your 4th. Well, why don't you just go back to 1 then? And let's start there. We just start from the beginning. I did that 4 times. I got really good at working steps 1, 2, and 3. I became one of those, what did you call it? Starter sponsor. Oh, yeah. Starter sponsee, I guess. Yeah. Starter sponsee. So I became like somebody that sounded really good to people who were just sick enough. So I started to get this huge posse of like sponsees. And it was quite an experience, I must say. They helped me through a time to actually find my way into the Al-Anon program. So if you mess up the program, that's fine. God's bigger than that. He'll find a way to reach you. And that he did that for me. And so I found myself in Al-Anon about 6 or 7 years, and I was just dying on the inside because I hadn't really applied any of the principles yet. I knew how to sound good. I knew what sounded like recovery, but I might as well have been a recording. Inside, I was hollow, just like my grandfather, just like a walking dead, you know? In fact, that's one of my favorite shows, as it turns out. And then there was a man that came into our home group, changed my life forever. And he said to me, he goes, I said, will you be my sponsor, you know, because I made another change. And he says, okay, fine. He goes, what do you think, Eric? You've done this a few times now. What do you think you need? And I said to him, well, I think I just need to finish that 4-step. It seems like it's taken me 6 or so years to do it, and it's killing me. He goes, no, that's not what you need at all. He says, you need a new experience, and you need one fast. Because guys like you don't live long. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He goes, a new experience means you need to have something different happen for you, and it has to be new. And I was like, oh, okay. And it turns out if you want to measure progress, you just measure how much stuff is new that's happening in your life. That's your progress. And so he says, okay, we're going to have you do step one a completely different way. Just make a list of all the ways that you try to overcome the effects of alcoholism. And let me know what you come up with. And so I was like, well, what's the effects of alcoholism? I mean, I didn't really understand the disease very well, but that question made me look at it much more carefully. And so I started to realize that that feeling of inadequacy, the feeling full of fear all the time, the feeling confused, unwanted, unloved, and alone. Those were all effects of alcoholism. So I started looking at, well, what did I do when I felt those things? And I started coming up with, like, you know, here's all the things I tried to do as my solution to alcoholism. Did things like I sulked, I kept secrets, I lied, I did really big favors, I apologized, I pretended problems didn't really exist. I gave expensive gifts. I argued. I fantasized. I nagged. I pushed. I complained. I hated people. I fought. I paid money. I took control. I played the martyr. I made demands. I made polite requests. And defended my views. I gave away credit for my own successes to others. I used tactics like public humiliation. I relied on my intellect and even physical intimidation as a way to get control. I made excuses. I pleaded. I protected others. I helped fix their problems, or at least I tried. I ignored people. I used humor and sarcasm. I embarrassed other people just to get my way. And what I discovered was like, you know, alcoholics have a very strange reaction to alcohol. And it turns out that I have, as an Al-Anon, an incredibly strange reaction to feeling powerless. Because, I mean, when you feel inadequate, isn't that just a form of powerlessness? When you're full of fear, well, isn't there a lot of powerlessness in that, too? And when you're confused, well, there's quite a bit of powerless in that, isn't there? And being unloved or unwanted and alone is filled with feeling powerless. The odd thing is I don't always feel powerless when I am powerless. For instance, there's a lady named Lin Chin in China right now. And she may be having some difficulties with money, but I don't feel powerless over that, even though I am. But there's something that happens in, to an Al-Anon like me when I start to care about somebody and then I feel powerless about what's happening. My disease kicks on like a thunderbolt. And I realized that all of these other ways to try and control and manipulate were really just my way of trying to run from feeling powerless into something else that feels more powerful. So I felt that I started to discover things like I would rather worry than feel powerless. Because look at how much I can worry. Wow, there's some power in that. And I'd rather get angry than feel powerless, because that's obvious. There's a lot more power in feeling angry than doing that. I would rather heap shame upon myself than feel powerless, because look at how much I can beat up myself. There's power in that. And I found that there was like this, like I heard it said, you know, that we're emotional drunks. And I was like, I thought that was just ridiculous until I discovered, for me, it's totally true. That the last thing I was willing to actually accept was that I have a problem with feeling powerless. And I have all kinds of knee-jerk, ego-driven reactions to that that no longer are a solution for me today. And then my sponsor says, okay, great. Now you know why you need a higher power. And I was like, yeah, and I need one really bad. And he goes, okay, cool. Now I want you to go and make, you've been in Al-Anon a little while, I want you to write down a list of the people that you've met in Al-Anon. And then next to their names, I want you to write down why you love them. I was like, okay. And so I made my list, and when I was done, he says, okay, now we're going to practice principles above personality. And we're going to do that thing that they talk about. We're going to do that. Take away the names. Those are the properties of your higher power and what your higher power thinks of you. And I discovered all kinds of really neat things about my higher power. This is the, you know, when people say, oh, higher power of my non-understanding, I'm like, let someone help introduce you to your higher power. I think that's the job of a sponsor, is to truly, like, reach in and help somebody introduce them to their higher power, the one that's really crazy about it. It just loves you and is all for you, not against you, ever. And the other thing I think a sponsor does best is they also introduce you to yourself. Because I know I had a self-loathing problem, a really big self-loathing problem for a lot of years, even in Al-Anon. And I thought I had to earn my way into, like, love and respect from you people. And I discovered that the greatest way to get love and respect from Al-Anons is to completely be vulnerable. It's also the thing that makes a man the strongest. Because it takes the most amount of strength for a man to completely just be vulnerable and tell you about his screw-ups and his faults. Because in Al-Anon, you know, we're only as sick as our secrets. And the other thing I learned about, you know, the importance of the principle behind step one really is honesty. It's about being honest. And the first thing we need to get honest about is what is our real relationship to ourselves, to other people, and the nature of this disease, so that we can get right-sized about that. And I once heard a really amazing AA speaker in LA say something really profound to me that shaped and changed my recovery. He said, essentially this, you know, if you fight reality, you get hurt. And this is why we're in a program of rigorous honesty. And it's because, as it turns out, that the more we open our minds and our hearts to what truly is, we discover incredible good news is everywhere to be found. That's... you know, the principle behind step two really is just to have that open mind. You know, step one tells us to look very clearly at our powerlessness and to make that admission. I've heard some people say, oh, you know, we admitted that we're powerless and our lives become unmanageable. And they thought they had done step one by admitting their lives were unmanageable. And I'd say to them, no, you missed the most important part in there. Because it takes nothing, right, to just staple the back of your palm up here to the top of your head, keep it there permanently, and talk about how much your life is unmanageable. That's easy. That doesn't take any spiritual muscle at all. The real effort in step one is saying, yeah, I'm powerless. Like, I'm not enough to take on this disease and beat it. When I came in, I thought that being powerless was a character defect. And I know people that come in and they're just feeling broken by this disease, like crushed, like they're a loser. I'm here to tell you, you're not. You're just human. You're like everybody else. A defect means there's something wrong with you that needs to be like uprooted and taken out. And being powerless over this disease turns out not to be a fatal malady unless you leave it untreated. And as it turns out, you know, the higher power that he introduces me to in step two, like, taught me all these really neat things about my higher power. He's not boring, for instance. I do not want a God in my life that bores me to death. Sorry. Not going to work. And they can't be mean, and they can't be fake either. And my higher power is funny. He's very unique. He loves really great music. He plays guitar with a really mean wah-wah. He's got tons of love to give, whether I think he has bad taste or not. And he likes to call me things like, my boy. I always wanted to hear that from my dad, with affection. And I got that from guys in Al-Anon. He helps me to feel that I totally belong, because I need help with that. He likes to have fun. He understands how hard life can be sometimes. He's warm, and he's welcoming, and he's kind. It's like a gentle giant. Just those are the concepts for me that, like, it's an archway through which is built by these characteristics that I can walk now into my freedom. And when I was finished having this sense of an understanding of my higher power, step three was a no-brainer. It's like, hey, Eric, how do you feel about turning your will and your life over to the care of something that those qualities? And I was like, let's do it. And I got through the fourth step, and I remember, like, when I was done it, I was very underwhelmed. I was sure that when I was done, somebody was going to say, see, you are a loser, you are an idiot, you are a fool, you are all these things you thought of yourself. And what I discovered instead is just how regular and human I am, which is what makes me belong in this universe. In fact, it gave me an arsenal of ways to reach in and really connect with other people. So my sponsor, I remember, like, he was sitting there and he's talking to me about, like, well, you know, I came in for the whole relationship problem thing, and I didn't know how to relate to people. And he was like, I remember we were talking about my marriage that I was in for about 13 years. And I go, well, that was certainly a long relationship. And he goes, I don't think so. And I'm like, you're a jerk. I'm like, come on, you know, like, that's actually, by legal standards, and I started giving him the law, you know, like, more than 10 years is actually a long relationship. He goes, yeah, but how much relating was going on? And I've since learned that if you want to improve your relationships with other people, you simply need to relate more. Could it be simpler than that? I don't know, man. And isn't that what we do when we go to our meetings? Even if you don't know that's what's going on. I remember going in the first meeting, and I'm like, I feel so separate from the whole world. I'm just a train wreck, you know, either happening or waiting to happen. And, you know, stuck up here with, you know, Al-Anon salute. And And you guys start talking about your process and what you feel and what you've gone through. And I'm sitting there in my mind going, oh, that's happened to me. That's happened to me. How did you know? Like in the literature, they're reading it. And I'm going, who got into my diary and's been reading it, you know? And I couldn't believe it. Same experience like you were talking about earlier. And I related. I was learning how to relate better in the first meeting. That's how quick Al-Anon can work. It's powerful stuff. And once you guys introduced me, you know, to my higher power, and you got me through this process of, like, the hardest part of the steps for me was to get past that major hurdle. And, you know, today I'm working through my ninth step. Just clearing the wreckage of the past. And it's been difficult, but I'm so glad I'm there working on that. And, you know, in Al-Anon, a lot of different things has happened to me over the time. And I've had the ups and downs that a lot of people have had. And a few that were larger than the average. And one of them was having my sister, Merritt, take her life under the pressures of this disease. And when that happened, you know, I was in the midst of the steps, and I still had all those sponsees around me that were still, like, for some reason, didn't think I was a loser. And they wanted whatever it is that I had in recovery. And they kept me facing, just constantly facing into the program. And so at the time, I might have been meeting with like 3 or 4 sponsees a week, 4, maybe 5 hours at a time, and like hitting meetings and doing sponsorship and just, I mean, I was doing it all. And they say that when you get kicked really hard by some big piece of life, it just kicks you in the direction that you went, that you're facing. And I was kicked into program deeply. And what I realized when my sister died was that that the disease had won the battle with her, and it was coming after me next. So I was dealing with depression. That was so, like, suffocating, and just, if you've ever been under the weight of depression, it's horrible. It's, like, terrible. And I remember, like, being too chicken to take my life, so I was more along the lines of going, well, what the heck is the point of continuing if pain just continues? And what happened was I dug way deeper into my recovery, and I just started to get more honest. And real. And I started asking questions in Al-Anon, like, my life depended on it, because it does. And I wasn't going to settle for BS. I had to get the truth. And what I discovered is step 3 is really just a choice between life and death, and we make it every day. You know, and when I do not practice a step 3, I am essentially choosing death. It might be a slow death. And the disease doesn't really care if it can kill me today or tomorrow. The truth is, it'll settle for making me absolutely miserable until it can kill me. And that became abundantly clear to me. And so I started to look at the people in Al-Anon as people that might not be with us tomorrow. And my love, my appreciation of people who would do that thing called keep coming back. Because so many people come in and then leave without ever really knowing what the Al-Anon program has to offer. And sometimes they leave thinking they understand what they're leaving. And to me, this day, one of my favorite things to do, it's probably the best form of service for me to do as a person in Al-Anon, is to help new people that are coming in to feel understood, to feel welcomed. and to let them know that I care about them and I love them and I want them to come back. And, you know, some of the guys in my home group look at me like, Eric, this is a new guy. Just go see Eric. You know, like, he'll go say hi to just about anybody. And the reality is it doesn't matter what shape you show up in. In fact, if you come in more broken, I just love you that much more because I know how broken I was when I came in. It's a way of paying back. The great, great gift that Al-Anon's given me. It's given me, like, my life, but it's also given me a way to live. And that's just so much better. Today, I practice sort of a conscious program. And by conscious, I mean, of course, I practice a program that helps me stay in conscious awareness of my higher power. But I've discovered that it's also very important to stay in contact with my conscious contact with my character defects and shortcomings so that they don't get a pass or the gift of anonymity. And I have found that it's that consciousness, the spiritual consciousness, has to be, they both have to happen together. If all I do is ever chase sort of like all that's really good in this world without ever looking at my shortcomings and defects, I have found that's a very hollow way of living and it's not real. But if I spend all of my time just simply dwelling on only my shortcomings and defects, that's even worse. What I've discovered is that when I keep a conscious awareness of my defects, it reminds me to surrender to my higher power. And that creates this sort of a yin-yang space where the darkness of my defects and the light of my higher power actually shine off of each other and I don't get overwhelmed by either of them. And I'll just finish by saying this. If you're new to Al-Anon, you're in a place that can transform your life, if you will let it. I hope you know how much we love you, even as you are now, even if you think we have bad taste. If you're in the last 30 days of Al-Anon, I want to extend the same loving warmth to you. And I want to say that what you think you're leaving may very well be not what it is. If you have plans that you think will work better, please come and tell me. I want to hear it. I'm one of those guys that, you know, tried to work his way out and graduate and all that. And I've only discovered that with recovery in Al-Anon, you would think maybe you would become less powerless. The more time you spend, the more time you work to recover. But my experience has told me that, and shown me that it's quite the opposite, and that's a good thing. More and more gets powerless as we look more and more at different parts of our lives, and that expands. But that means more and more of our lives gets touched by the fellowship and by our higher powers. That makes it better and better and better. And so, you know, open up, let people know what's really going on. And we're here for you, too. We love you. Thank you for letting me share.